The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the sixth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, we've wandered away a little, I think, from the central theme of this series of talks, democracy and the Bible. I don't regret it. We have to have some of these illustrations and decorative material. But I'm coming back to the center of our theme in suggesting that we speak today of the giving of the law to the people, to the Israelites that come out of Egypt, to the people as a whole, the giving of the law as a democratic act, thinking of it as God addressing himself, the only instance we know of in any religion or in any myth or history, of God addressing himself to the people in assembly, that all of them might be there, is my first idea. And the second is that we might discuss the question of the chosen people and democracy, whether there is in the concept of the chosen people an anti-democratic background or suggestion.
Yes, people might think so, and I dare say have thought so. Let me go back just for a minute, however, Maurice, to your remark that we had wandered from the center of the subject, presumably in our last two talks about the Sabbath. In my opinion, we had not wandered. It doesn't make any difference. I don't want to quibble. But for me, the Sabbath was particularly relevant to our whole topic because it was a symbol of egalitarianism, was it not? That is to say, the Sabbath made men equal.
Yeah, well, I suppose what I really mean is that we didn't mention the word democracy.
Oh, I see.
That,
well,
pedagogically, I had slipped away from the intent of our talks.
Well, all right.
But not
but
in
I'm,
substance.
But I tend to find democracy and equality so close together, so almost wedded or welded into one thing, that I can't separate them.
You're perfectly right. And I think that we find another illustration. I suggest we find another illustration in the subject I've just raised. And the statement in Deuteronomy, this is in the last days of Moses when he's addressing the people after their 40 years of wandering. He recapitulates what happened to them, and he reminds them, asks them, did a thing like this ever happen before? And we can say, no, as far as we know, it didn't happen before, and it hasn't happened since. And he goes on to say, did ever a people, not just an individual, because individuals had, did ever a people hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as thou hast heard and lived, or as God tried to go and take him, a nation, from the midst of another nation?
Yes, it's almost a rhetorical question, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, he reminds them that it wasn't the individual, it was the people as a whole. And then, again, I remember how this was impressed on me in my childhood in the ceremony of the Passover, how we repeated year after year that it wasn't only the generation at Sinai which was taken from the midst of another people, but all the ensuing generations, including myself and my twin sister, my little sister, and my grown-up brother, all of us sitting at table there were made to understand that we had been a party to this covenant.
Yes, and I'm sure it's of the highest significance that the voice of God was heard above a mountain in an extremely desert portion of the world. Now, Sinai is a very deserted mountain, isn't it? And the region all around it is desert. The voice of God was not heard by the people back in Egypt, where they were, to be sure, subject to the Egyptians, but which was a land of milk and honey. Neither was it to be heard when they got to the land where they were going.
Yes.
And where they were going to form themselves into a nation,
This was the symbol that the law was in the public domain.
That's right.
I've often reflected that the Bible is in the public domain. If the Jews could only collect the royalties on the Bible in the various languages, there would be no problem connected with all of our philanthropies or with the funds that are being raised for Israel.
Yes, but there was. There.
The Bible is the public domain, and that's the symbol of it.
Yes, but there it happened. Out in the... in no man's land, as it were, out...
And therefore every man's land.
Therefore every man's land. It happened on this mountain, which I've never seen. Have you seen it?
No, I've passed near it.
Is it true that it's a desert region?
Oh, you can't imagine anything more desolate than that. There's just the... I've passed there mostly in the summer, the black rock and the blazing yellow sand, and you get the feeling that there is no life in the air, even the microbes have been killed, can't find nourishment. I suppose it isn't as bad as all that, but it is a desolation.
Yes, well, and that's highly significant to me, as I was saying. It happened, therefore, almost in an abstract place, a place abstracted from society, from law, from previous laws, from organizations of all sorts. The people of the world, as it were being addressed there. Although, am I right in saying that? Was it just these people?
It was, and then there are these illustrative and highly suggestive commentaries that God offered the law individually to other peoples and they refused it. The Ten Commandments specifically, that he offered it to one people, and they asked what's in it, and he said, thou shalt not kill. They said, oh, we can't accept that, we live by killing. Thou shalt not steal. And other people said, oh no, we're a robber nation, we can't live without stealing. And so on through all the negative commandments, and it was only the Jews who said, in the great phrase, Naaseh v'nishma, we will hear and we will do and we will listen or we will obey. But it was offered to all the world, whether individually to each people or in one great offer which nobody else would accept. The implication is this is mankind's heritage and not the heritage of a particular people, which leads me on to this question of the discomfort that many Jews feel in the phrase, the chosen people.
Yes.
Now, tell me, how do you react to that phrase? Does it awaken in you some feeling of exclusiveness or of assumed superiority, of standoffishness? This is the great big club of the Jews and nobody can enter it?
No. If it ever did, it certainly has not, to me, in my memory. These people were chosen to hear these words because it was certain in God's mind that they would understand them. Remember, he said once, as if he himself had been troubled about this, I chose these people not for any reason other than that I loved them. Now, I think his love for them was inseparable from his belief in them, his confidence that they would comprehend, that they could absorb this wisdom, which is the highest wisdom I think mankind still has, and that's why we're talking about it here this summer. I would say that they were chosen only in that sense. They were a select audience who would understand and who would continue to understand and repeat these words and observe these laws and be imitated by as many other people on earth as...
That's it. Now, that is the...
As pleased to imitate them.
That is what I was listening for. Be imitated by as many people on earth as wanted. There is a
and that
terrible...
Has happened. And that has happened.
Yes, there is a terrible misunderstanding. Almost a willful abuse by certain people, when they trace racialism to the concept of the chosen people, forgetting that the whole of the narrative is sprinkled liberally with instances which deny any kind of racial exclusivity. To begin with...
What a word that was, by the way.
Yes. To begin with, Moses himself married a non-Jewess. Presumably she became Jewish. We know this, that it's not specifically stated that she became Jewish, not in the Bible text itself.
Yeah.
But the Bible text itself does say that when Jethro, the father of Zipporah, the wife of Moses, that Jethro, when he encountered Moses before the giving of the law at Sinai, was deeply moved by what had happened, by the liberation from Egypt, and he became, in effect, a Jew. Again, we're not told that he entered the Abrahamic covenant, but he declared himself a follower of the God of Moses. We presume that the daughter did too.
Well,
there you have a Jew marrying out into a non-Jewish tribe, the greatest Jew of all. And then, actually, people are apt to forget that the matriarchs, the four matriarchs, who are so tenderly remembered by the Jews, the wives of the three patriarchs, were non-Jewish. They came from that old heathen family which Abraham had detached himself from. They were taken out from that family, from heathen idol-worshipping surroundings, and assimilated into the Jewish people.
Yes, I was thinking of them and of the great love that their husbands had for them and the utter absence of doubt that they belonged, finally, to
Israel. Oh, they are the dearest figures in the women folk of the Jewish lore. The four matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel. Of course, particularly Rachel, who's a tender love for all her offspring is a thematic recurrence in all of religious and even in secular folklore. And they forget that they were born among non-Jews. Their childhood was in a heathen environment. And still people talk about racialism as having been promulgated by the concept of the chosen people.
Yes, and then, of course, there is the, to me, very famous and touching case of in the book of Ruth, of Naomi, a Moabitess who was received, you know, remember when she came back with her daughter-in-law, received in utter simplicity, it seems to me, by Boaz and
yes,
by the people there during that barley harvest. There was no difficulty in that return and that assimilation, if you please.
There are steps in that, now you mention it, that when she came, she had the right of the stranger, the alien.
Yes.
She was an alien, Ruth. She had the right of the stranger to participate in the social security of the time, which was that she could gather the from the corners of the field and the sheaves, the ears of corn that had been dropped and the fruit that had come to the earth in a windfall, and step by step she was drawn to the people and became drawn into the people and became the ancestress of David and therefore of the Messiah. There again is an instance of complete negation of the concept of racialism or of the foreignhood of peoples to the privilege of the Torah.
You know, I'm interested in the fact that the prophets, who of course come late in the whole story and who speak after the various captivities which had been so disastrous to the Jews and yet also spiritually maybe so so creative for them, I'm interested in the fact that they are always talking this language that you say was talked. Remember Isaiah, I will gather all speaking, putting these words into the mouth of God, I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. All nations and tongues. And Amos says once, are ye not as children of the Ethiopians unto me, O children of Israel, saith the Lord.
Yes, there wasn't...
That's about as far away as you could get.
As far as we... It was the end of the world to them,
yes.
I suppose. The
way off in Africa.
Southern stretches of the Dead Sea.
And the people are most alien, very alien in all sorts of ways. Are ye not as children of the Ethiopians unto me, O children of Israel?
And interestingly enough, until this day, the Ethiopians claim their descent from Jewish sources.
Yes.
There are perhaps some descendants of Jews among them, Mark, but I don't suppose they are ethnically Jewish at all. The another instance that you evoked to my mind just now is the sending of Jonah, who went reluctantly, the sending of Jonah to Nineveh. Nowhere are we told that when... Nowhere is it hinted in the slightest ever. Nowhere is it adumbrated at all that when he went there, he told them, you've got to become Jews and then you'll be saved. No. They were to turn back from their evil ways and their lives would be spared. And so it was. Yes. Much to Jonah's chagrin.
because
he was a reluctant savior.
Yes, it was almost as if he wished they had something terrible happen to them
yes.
To justify his warnings. Well,
there's some...
am I right, Maurice, in saying, as I did a moment or so ago, that this understanding increases in depth in the era of the prophets? Isaiah, Jeremiah.
It was pretty deep before, if we are
yes,
to take the Bible chronologically. There it comes to its grandest utterance. It was implicit before.
Oh, sure. But now listen, this is why that question interests me so much. Of course it was implicit before and maybe fully stated. Nevertheless, the glorious fullness with which Isaiah, for instance, states it, and Jeremiah, suggests to me that there was something very remarkable in the fact that the Jews in their time of troubles, in their time of very great troubles, did not build a wall about themselves. They can, even more than before.
Saying, in other words...
They said, this is for everybody.
Never saying, cursed be the world because of the way it has treated us.
That's right.
That has never happened. But what you say is correct, that it reached a magnificence of expression in the prophets, but the substance of it was to be found, is to be found, let us say, in Solomon's prayer in the temple. And there again, he doesn't speak of somebody becoming a Jew. He speaks of someone addressing God at large. You remember the prayer?
No, what does he say?
Now, when he is dedicating the temple, he has prayed for wisdom as the greatest gift that he can have in administering the people. And he has asked that this temple be used thus and thus, that God should listen to this and this. That has been his supplication. And he goes on to say, now concerning a stranger that is not of thy people, Israel, but cometh out of a far country for thy name's sake, when he shall come and pray toward this house, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and do according to all that the stranger calleth to thee for.
Mm-hmm.
This is an astounding extension of a human feeling. Doesn't ask that he be circumcised, doesn't ask that he accept the Sabbath and the law. He asks only that he accept God.
Yes.
And if he turns to God in the spirit which should animate a person so addressing himself, then he prays that his supplication shall be listened to.
The
now,
assumption...
this contains all that the prophets have so magnificently embroidered in their later utterances.
However, Maurice, there is the assumption there, isn't there, that it is to God that he will pray.
It is to God that he will pray.
The one God whom Solomon assumes to be...
The
only God to whom
thought,
prayers
the
can
thought
go.
There is, I presume, that if he comes to this God to pray to him, as he might pray to any other God, supposing he goes from God and prays to, let us say, I don't know, to the Magna Mater Cybele of the Phrygians. Then he goes and prays to Sabazius somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Then he is not praying to God at all.
No.
And the spirit in him isn't that of a worshipper who sees mankind in its unity, but he's saying to himself, well, let me try this one as well.
Yes.
He may be all right.
Yes, whereas that would not be in Solomon's mind. The amazing difference is between a man who might have gone and bowed before some idol, some physical construction that he called God, and then, as you say, just tried this one. No, this God is the invisible one. You see, the great thing about this God is that he has never been seen. He was heard by all the people that day in the thunder and the lightning over that great mountain. His voice was clearly heard. Now, and Moses himself saw him just a little bit. Moses came down from the mountain and with the tablets. Moses was the conveyor of the laws, to be sure. But Moses had seen him. The voice, however, was heard by everybody. But he remained an invisible God, which is the essential thing about him.
And this was what used to puzzle
that's the great thing.
Many of the pagans. But what you said before is interesting, very interesting, that the prophets developed it in a way that doesn't occur in the earlier ones. Here, in the case of Solomon's prayer, you have a stark simplicity of intent. But the magnificent imagination of the prophets, let us say of Isaiah, couldn't rest content with the simplicity alone, although they have simple passages. Remember that section at the end of, I think it's chapter 19 of Isaiah, when he speaks of drawing in all the peoples to the recognition of the one God. And let us remember, he is speaking of Egypt and of Assyria, as we might speak today of Egypt and of Syria, as we might speak today of the German people, from whom we have inherited very dark memories, recent memories.
Yeah.
He has this to say. In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians, and in that day shall Israel be the third with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance.
Mm.
Now, this is a clue passage. There are many such passages.
Well,
there's a magnificent statement.
It is amazing.
It is put in.
Right.
It is put in what I would call a three-dimensional context.
Yeah.
It is palpable, as it were.
Yes. It is sculptured. Well, that's all I wanted to hear you say, because it has been borne upon in upon me by my reading that that in the prophets everything in the Bible tends to assume something like its final and perfect expression. But this happened in times of such dreadful difficulty, such almost unthinkable pain, that I sometimes think it's the most glorious achievement of the Jews, that in their pain and in their distress, in their exile, in their separation from everything that they owned and had loved, they could keep on thinking these things. They could keep on saying these things. Somebody could at any rate.
Oh, yes. Oh, there were men who could rise above the anguish of the moment and say that there is no human solution in retribution, revenge, the recollection of the wrongs done us. There can only be one solution, and that is the lifting of the entire world to the level to which we have aspired, to which anyone whatsoever, whosoever, can aspire equally. This is the immense international democracy of Judaism. We've spoken of Jewishness, the Bible, and is democracy in regard to individuals. But there was a democracy of peoples. I remember now, it occurs to me, there are passages in the very early part of our Bible in which the territorial integrity of peoples is affirmed forever. You remember when the Jews were approaching the Promised Land, they were specifically warned that when they passed by the territory of Edom, they should not harass the Edomites and they should not trouble them. And the statement is, I will not give you not as much space as your foot shall cover, because I have given this land as an inheritance to the children of Seir. And again, with regard to Moab and to Ammon, said, you shall not harass them, and you shall not discomfort them, for I will not give you their land. This is there the law is laid down. There is no conquistadorial attitude in that, let's call it spiritual ambition, if you like. The spiritual ambition of the Jewish people did not connote an imposition of the law upon other peoples other than by persuasion and by their coming to see the one God in the same spirit as the Jews.
Of course, Maurice, later on, when Joshua enters the Promised Land, he does a pretty savage execution upon a number of peoples, destroys cities, appropriates
and
places.
But even there, Mark, there are curious mitigations in the Bible. And I want to go back to the thought that I expressed some weeks ago, that you must look, one must look in the Bible for the general tendency. We discover, for instance, this injunction to the Jews, you must destroy them because you will learn evil ways from them. But they didn't destroy them, and it was apparent that no punishment was laid upon them for not having destroyed them, because let us take a couple of incidents like the following. Bathsheba, I don't know whether she was Jewish in origin or not, or Israelite, we would say, we are not told, was married to a Hittite.
Yes.
Uriah the Hittite. He was one of the great captains of David's army. There's no suggestion anywhere that David did wrong at having a Hittite captain living in Jerusalem. On the contrary, he was supposed to safeguard the rights of Uriah and his great sin. The one blot on the brilliant career of David is that he wronged this alien. Or again, the Jebusites were presumed to have been destroyed or should have been destroyed. Nevertheless, David bought the land on which he wanted to build the temple, the altar to God, from Arauna, the Jebusite, and paid him for it.
Yes.
Didn't grab it from him as a conqueror and as the king, went and conducted negotiations, so that this these passages that we find, this destroy all the inhabitants of the land. And then you find the contradiction to it in, there was Arauna the Jebusite, and there was Uriah the Hittite. Then you must take the whole context and say, in what direction is this striving? And we come back to the thought that we examined toward the beginning of this series. We come back to the thought that the it is an original inspiration from which the people defected.
Yeah.
It was Ezekiel Kaufman's view that there came a vision of God and perfection. The people defected and wrote these things, and they kept striving back to the height from which they had tumbled.
Yes, they defected, and in so doing became perilously like other peoples without the law, other peoples who had not had the privilege of hearing these things said on Sinai, and who had not the privilege of being able or free to remember them. Well, that's what it all comes down to for me. Namely, that these people were chosen to be told something that it was believed they could understand. And I do think that they were the only people in the whole universe who could have understood it at the moment. That is their distinction. Now, you could put it another way. You could say they had ideas that have never had been had anywhere else. But I don't think it was a matter of they just having ideas. It was a revelation to them, was it not? It was spoken unto them, but spoken unto them by a God who had complete faith that they would understand. And, as you say, from time to time, forget, but again remember, and then forget, and then remember.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 6th in the 15-week Eternal Light Summer Series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.